Praise the Lord, church. It's good to be here on a Wednesday night. I got my main usher passing out some handouts if anybody wants to help him. You don't necessarily have to take one each. It's not the smallest printing we've ever had here, thanks to the prophecy chart we got a few weeks ago. But it didn't come out as clear as I had hoped. And I did this. I wanted to print this up for everybody because I didn't want to make whoever's in the booth panic tonight. It's a lot of scriptures. Don't worry. We're going to get right through. We're not going to read them all. But it's I wanted to show in the story we're going to talk about the parallel between some of the Gospels. So we'll get to that in a minute. Like Pastor said, four kids and life is... busy, going as fast as can be. I don't necessarily have to tell anybody that. It's not a competition of who's busiest. Everybody's busy, and everybody has a lot of stuff going on. And sometimes you can try to pretend like you're busy just so, hey, get out of my way, I'm busy. If you walk around work with a clipboard and just real fast, I don't have time for that. Everybody just assumes you're busy, right? And there's real busy, and there's exhaustion, and there's sometimes just trying to pretend like you're just making it and trying to not let everybody see that sometimes it's not an overcoming situation. And keeping your head up, walking into church, seeing everybody, trying to, stay strong and try to be encouraging to people. We went out to eat Sunday night with some newlyweds, or not yet newlyweds, but engaged couple, and they were ass picking our brain about marriage, and we've only had 15 years of marriage, and I realize with this group, that's basically newlywed. I get it, but I have learned a couple of things in 15 years. I definitely learned that if you filmed the video of your honeymoon with just you and your wife, just events, places you went to, things you saw, just in case, don't show that video to your 12 and 11-year-old kids, because they're going to get grossed out at the kissing and hey, babe, sometimes innuendos, as men will do, and we're married, it's all under the blood, everything's safe. But my 11 and 12-year-olds, I finally said, I'm so uncomfortable, we just have to turn this off. And we watched the wedding video, and after we watched the wedding video, it's like looking at these two kids that just had no idea what they were getting into, just absolutely cringeworthy. When we say the vows, you don't have a clue what you're saying on that day. Not one person would remember. They're just repeating whatever you said, whatever you said to make this go faster so we can be married. Let's just get it over with. Let's just say it and be done with it. And I'm watching the kiss, when you may kiss the bride, it's like, ugh. We see, sappy love posts we used to put on social media and just, ugh. Why? Because we have 15 years now of learning what love was. And love wasn't on the wedding day. I mean, there was a level of love, but it wasn't the love that I share now. It wasn't that experience along the way. And so we sat there recounting, telling this couple of our stories. And obviously, there's so many things to laugh at. Like the time Rachel tried to charge and thought she was going to knock me over. She pretty soon found out that she's about half my size, and it didn't work out so well for her. We laugh about it now. But in that moment was a very, very real moment for us. That moment was a very, very, I would say, crystallizing event. And, of course, we can laugh about it and the joke and her look of shock, as she's looking up at the ground like, oh, I can't believe you would just stand there and let me do that. And such is the walk that we have, that I can look back after 15 years and I can certainly say I love her more now than I've ever loved her. But there were certainly days when I had to learn that love and we had to grow in that love. And the story that I want to talk about tonight is a story with Jesus walking on water, but I came up with the generic title, and it was this: Remember the Loaves and the Fishes. Because we tend to have this sense, and sometimes, you know, it's like when in a marriage, you know, you have a sense, sometimes you're in a fight and you're, well, you always do, you know, do this, you always do this. And you can forget sometimes about the good. You can forget about things that have happened, that transpired, that actually progressed. You can sometimes, when you're walking with the Lord, we have this spiritual amnesia where the new battle that we're in, we tend to forget what we have already been out of and how we've already been carried through and brought through in the past circumstances. Remember the loaves and the fishes. Don't forget the times that God's worked for us. And there's a cycle that happens with what I call spiritual amnesia. Amnesia is characterized by two specific things: trouble learning new information and trouble remembering past events or previously familiar information. My wife, many times, again, I keep referring to her, but this is my, you know, what I draw from in my own life, is constantly telling me that I don't remember things. And I wouldn't know, because how does somebody that forget things remember whether or not they knew them or not, right? So it's really easy for me to think, I don't remember that. Of course I don't. I mean, she could be making up all kinds of facts and information. And if I don't remember things, how would I know this? How would I be able to recall what I said, you know, December 13th of, you know, 2012 at such and such a time? You know, I mean, like, she will remember the down to the detail. And it's kind of, sometimes it's sad, because I have to think about, like, what all have I forgotten? Like, do we have a fifth kid that I've just forgotten about? You know, I mean, like, is it, and I'll tell a story, and boy, I tell you, I remember the spirit of a story, but if I get one little fact wrong, she will kill the spirit of that story to make sure I got that fact right, right? Forgetting things, amnesia, it's not characterized by what we see in the movies. People don't wake up typically and just forget who they are, but they have trouble learning new things. They have trouble remembering familiar cycles. And that's why I call it amnesia, because I think we're going to see a familiar cycle. The story, it was mostly known, it's in Matthew and Mark and in John, and that's what I have there on that sheet of paper. So there's a sheet of paper there, and I know it's hard to read. It didn't print up great. But I like seeing the parallels in a story. There's, you know, we've always talked about multiple witnesses. I know we've heard this before. In a story, you know, if there's been a crime and multiple witnesses are coming forward, you know, it's not unusual to have differing facts and differing view of the events. And a lot of times it's based on the viewpoint and how someone saw it. You know, if the sun's shining right, someone may say, well, it was a, you know, a gray Nissan driving eastbound, you know, and another person could say, well, it was like a sedan, it was kind of beige-ish, you know, and they were going that direction, and there was, you know, one of the tires had a hubcap that was off, or, you know, and another person could give a different account in different ways. And so, like, officers and detectives are used to hearing differing opinions in the story. If it's too exact, then you basically got plagiarism. I mean, you know, and if two people have the exact same story, exact same events, exact same everything, then they start to wonder. So there's three times that the story of Christ walking on water appears. And so what this chart does is this actually just gives us a parallel of the three stories in the three Gospels between Matthew's Gospel, Mark's Gospel, and John's Gospel. And there's definitely some very identical things, and there's some things that we can draw on from the story, because there's some things that Mark says that John and Matthew didn't say, and there's something that John says. And so you start to piece kind of this story together. And so we're going to start in Matthew chapter 14. We're going to go to verse 22. I don't know that they'll have all the scriptures up there. And the translation I use is a very simplified translation, and they may not be able to find it, which is fine. There's one thing that all of these authors do agree, and all these books agree, and it's that this story happens right after the feeding of the 5,000, Okay, so a miracle has just taken place. And, you know, probably afternoon to evening time seems to make the most sense. Probably early afternoon because you'd want everybody to have time to go home. And so Jesus feeds the 5,000. There's a miracle. There's 12 baskets left over. And if there's 12 baskets left over, then I think the assumption is everybody is really, really full. And you are definitely, you've eaten a lot of food, right? So there's, you know, it's not like where there's just barely enough skipping by. Like you really, there's everybody's full. Now, I don't know where the 12 baskets went, but right now we're looking at all the disciples. And so they all agree that this just happened. Their bellies were full of energy. And now here we go. So starting at chapter 14, verse 22 of Matthew, it says, immediately he, being Jesus, made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. So you have to, number one, he sent them on. Now this is right off the bat, you know, okay, so it's not a really far journey from where they are. If you look at the map in the Sea of Galilee, they're kind of in the northeastern part of the Sea of Galilee, which is not really big. It's a big lake, but it's a sea. They call it the Sea of Galilee, and it's about the northeastern part, and where they need to get to is about 4 to 5 miles by sea. It may be walkable, so there's a chance that when Jesus leaves them, maybe they just assume that he's going to take a different way. Maybe he'll be there in a few days. Maybe he'll catch another boat. But they go off, so they all agree on that side of it. And again, if you're following the parallel just for fun to kind of see where the stories diverge, where they're, you know, all similar. And but they leave for their journey then in the evening time. So you have to anticipate that if they were leaving in the evening, this was probably going to be a pretty quick journey. They're already walking with the Lord. This is probably going to be a quick journey. They're leaving at nighttime, and they're full. We're good. We'll probably get there real quick, get a good night's sleep. 4 to 5 miles shouldn't be a problem, right? This isn't their first time in a boat. They've done this before. And then verse 24 says, but by this time the boat was battered by waves and was far from land, for the wind was against them. So now we see that they're in a storm, right? Well, okay, you're not going to get very far if you're deciding that if you're trying to get out and, you know, especially, I mean, if you sail, and I got to tell you, I don't know much about sailing. It's always fascinated me because you can watch skilled sailors with the wind in at them, and they can kind of figure out where they need to go. And they can figure out how to move the sails, how to move the boat, how to zigzag across. They can figure this out. But it's been a long time, and they haven't been able to move. And so we go to verse 25, and this is where verse 25, Matthew says, and early in the morning he came walking towards them on the water. But before that, if you notice, there's something that John says, and you can go all the way to that third column in verse 19. John says, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles. So you need to picture this. So they're about 4 to 5 mile journey. They're already out 3 to 4 miles. In their journey, and so they're kind of finished, but it says that they're rowing, so they're exhausted. And I looked up the average time if somebody could row, so a rowing team, and it was anywhere from like six minutes per mile to like the average rower could do about 12 minutes per mile. So you figure in, if you're at a 4 to 5 mile, okay, you should be around an hour, you know, you could probably get where you need to go. But we find that now it's kind of early morning, verse 25 tells us. Verse 25 says, and early in the morning he came walking towards them on the water. So they left in the evening, which I don't like to travel in the evening at all. I can't stay awake. If I don't mind getting up early, I'll be happy to get up early. But they left in the evening. So it must have been something that they thought they could get there fairly quickly. But now they estimate probably it could have been around 3 o'clock in the morning. So, I mean, you can do the math here and realize these guys have been rowing. They're exhausted. The food in the belly is probably now gone, right? All the energy that we had, and now I'm exhausted. I'm rowing. Jesus, you sent me out here. Here I am, I'm rowing. And then they all agree. Again, we'll read Matthew 26. He said, but when the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. It is a ghost. So they all agreed they're scared. Mark and Matthew are the two who refer to it as a ghost. So, I mean, Jesus has been talking about death. There's Sawyer. Hi, babe.
Hi.
He's been talking about death. And so they're terrified because here they are, exhausted, seeing what's going on. They're in the boat. They're worn out, tired. Remember, this is the Wednesday night crowd that's in the boat. Okay? These aren't people who are just come to the Lord. These are they've seen miracles. But they're exhausted. And here comes Jesus. And what's the first thing that they think? Somebody killed him. They're terrified. Because only a ghost could walk on water. So you start putting this into perspective where their minds are, where their thoughts are. Here we are stuck in the middle of the sea. How long is this going to take if the wind's blowing? Eventually, and I'll add my own kind of, you know, thought into this. I think sometimes you have to do that. It's not necessarily in there, but, you know, it can be inferred. I mean, if the winds are against you and the sea is against you and you're exhausted and you're tired, I mean, water can get in boats. Waves come. And you're taking on water, and you're tired, and how much longer can we keep going? Should we go back? You know, have you ever made that mistake when you get off at a wrong exit or you miss your exit on the highway? You know, huh? Should I pull the illegal U-ey and, you know, risk it? Or, you know, how long's the next one? You know, and if you see, you know, where's my turn back point? Where's the point when I just need to go back, or should I just try to keep going forward? And so Jesus is out there walking on water. And then Peter says something, and it's only Matthew. Well, first, and of course, Jesus says, you know, it is I, take heart, you know, do not be afraid. In verse 28, Matthew's the only one that mentions Peter. So he gives us a little bit of insight, but he's the only one that mentions Peter. So Peter answers him, Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water. So, like, what is Peter? My first thought is, what in the world is Peter's motivation for this? You could probably, you could guess a lot of things. Does he just want to be close to Jesus? Does he think that, you know, something's not right here? Is it selfish? Does he just want out of the boat because they're not going anywhere and Jesus is, like, walking and he's like, yeah, forget this. I'm tired of being in this boat. We're all exhausted. We're tired. It looks like Jesus is going to go on and get a good night's sleep. I'm going with Jesus. We don't know motives necessarily, but what we know is actions. And so Peter, he says, and so regardless of why he decided to get out of the boat and follow Jesus, he says, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Jesus said, come. So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, and we know this story, it's familiar, he became frightened and beginning to sink, he cried, Lord, save me. Now, there was something that happened that I think was interesting that Mark said in chapter 6, verse 48, and this is what I find really, really interesting before Peter went all this. And this is where I wonder if where the motive came. Mark said, he intended to pass by us. Imagine that. Now, they all don't say that. Mark says that in his recollection of the story. He said, Jesus intended to walk past us. So if he intended to walk past, and you got to think in terms of how far was this? If Jesus is just going to walk past them, was it, hey guys, I'll meet you over on this side? Did he not see them? Did, you know, obviously they've got to be within earshot in a storm. They've got to be close enough. There's no way after a 3-mile walk, 2 to 3-mile walk, if Jesus is walking out there, there's no way Jesus didn't see them. But the perception was, I'm going to miss Jesus if I stay here. And Peter decides, all right, I'm getting out of the boat. Moment of faith, right? I'm getting out of the boat. Whether for whatever motivation, he says, I'm getting out of the boat. Lord, if it's you, he said, I want to come. And so this is where we know the story. This is where the story gets really interesting. I really don't know how bad a storm has to be to want to get out of the boat. We went snorkeling, was it 2 summers ago? And I've been snorkeling before, and I'm a lot heavier since the last time. And they gave me this little, like, life preserver to put on. And it just happened to be the same life preserver that Reese had and that Jensen had. And I got into the water, and I had the worst time of my life because I didn't care what was underneath me. There could have been sharks underneath me. I don't care. We actually went into a cage with sharks, and all I could think was, dear God, it's not going to be a shark that gets me. I'm going to drown because I had the same life-saving device that my children do. And I cannot stay above water. Water's coming in, my goggles, my glasses. And then they do the all call. We have to go back to the ship. So we go back to the ship. And of course, Chubby is the last one to get on the boat. I'm all the way in the back. All the way in the back. The whole boat's waiting on me. And the lifeguard kept saying, here, you want the life preserver? I said, nope. I'm not grabbing that life preserver with everybody on the boat watching me right now. Like, I would rather be the chubby guy who's just out of shape versus admitting that I'm literally feeling like I'm about to die right now. So I don't know what in the world would make Peter decide he wanted to get out of the boat in rough seas, rough storm. And the only thing I can think of was, regardless of motivation, Jesus was outside the boat. And Peter has seen enough to know that that's where he wants to be, is with Jesus. And there's something about, no matter what storm we're in, what trial we're in, we're here enough. This is the boat crew. And there's something about just knowing that if I can just get to Jesus, if I can just get, and I'm telling you, it doesn't matter what your motive was, it doesn't matter exactly, but you know in your spirit that that's where I need to be. And that's what Peter does. That's what Peter feels, and that's what Peter wants to do. Maybe he was complacent, tired, I don't know. Did he think, hey, look at me, you know, where there were squabbles over leadership and who was going to be the first, who was going to be the greatest. So maybe there was that, hey, I'm going to show these guys, I'm really going to show them who's going to be, you know, the one who's going to step up and be in charge. Watch it. I don't know what the motive is, but I know what he did. He decided to get out of the boat. And so it says here, we know that he started to walk. He came towards Jesus, verse 30. And there's something about when we follow Jesus, there always will take, and you see this in the Bible, every time someone to follow, it took movement on someone's part. The lame man was let down through a roof. He had to move to Jesus. Zacchaeus, you know, climbed up in his tree. Even Lazarus, when he was called, still had to come out of the tomb by himself. There is movement, and this is the movement crowd, right? This is the crowd that at whatever time and place, you could probably point to a place where you decided to get out of the boat. You decided, this is the journey I'm on. We're too far. We're 3 to 4 to 5 miles into a 5-mile journey. We're almost there. Man, I want to be with Jesus because the boat I'm in right now is not going. I'm going to make this effort. I'm going to jump out. And that's why he said, if you, Lord, bid me come. And there's something about, you know, if you're in the middle of a storm, if you're in the middle of the sea, if you're in the middle of the night, if you're in the middle of something, it's a good time to reach out for Jesus. It's a good time to decide that you're going to step out of the boat. And so that's what Peter does. And Peter quickly learns as he walks that when I was a kid, I always thought I didn't blame Peter. I feel like everybody always blames Peter for like his lack of faith, for sinking and starting to sink. And we're going to read that here. So it says, verse 30 says, but when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me!" This is the moment that Peter takes a lot of we disparage him, I think maybe unfairly, because
Men weren't meant to walk on water. He got to walk on water at least a little bit, right? And I would imagine, again, allow me to put some of my thoughts into the story. I don't think it was just a simple starting to sink and then cry out. I think Peter is at the point, like Matt, where Matt was swimming, trying to stay above water, exhausted, and finally realizing, like, okay, this isn't working right now. What I've done, I've stepped out, I'm trying, and I think there has to be, and just seeing Peter's personality throughout the scriptures, my guess is it wasn't just a slow sink before he cried out. I think, allow me to put that into the story, Peter was around boats. He was a fish. He knew how to fish. He was used to boats. You don't think he knew how to swim? Well, I guess if this isn't going to work, I'm just going to go ahead and I'm just going to swim to Jesus, you know? But the waves and the wind, and what does Peter say? He says, became frightened. And he thinks, he says, Lord, save me. And there's, in that moment of drowning, the exhaustion, you can't breathe. You're tired. You're taking on water into your lungs. Panic can set in. And regardless of what your motivation was to get you out there, now you're left with a really, really serious problem because you're drowning. You've got everybody else in the boat now. You know, what are they thinking? I got to go, Peter. Yeah, now we got to save you and figure out how to get here. They tell you if someone's drowning, you need to be, don't dive in after them. Be very cautious if somebody's drowning and you're in deep water, because they will have a tendency, because they will be grasping at anything to be saved, and they will pull you under with them. And one of the things they tell you is that if you're actually someone drowning, if you're in that situation, it would be better to let them drown, recover them, and then you can actually bring, you know, give them CPR. But you need to be very cautious. If you don't have a life-saving device on you, if you don't, just jumping in to save somebody, especially if they're the same size. Pastor, the other Wednesday, you talked about, you know, not going swimming because you were going to drown in pants if you wore jeans. So here's Peter drowning. Just take it in water. He's exhausted. He's tired. And this is one of those moments of the learning to love, the learning to live moments. And realizing that in this story is not a perfect moment, but it's a perfecting moment. The difference between what we see in the world and on social media and the pictures that we portray is perfect moments, and they don't really exist. The walk with the Lord is not so that you have a perfect moment, it's perfecting moments. The goal is to perfect us as saints. The goal is to perfect us inside. When you're taking on water, it's so easy to think, well, the Lord's left me. I'm done. I'm out. I couldn't walk on water long enough. I think that is probably in pride. If that was me and I got two steps on water and now I'm drowning, you know what I'm doing? I'm looking for the underwater ladder on my own. I walked on water. I can do it again. I got through this. I can do it again. It's that the self-sufficiency that he was able to overcome this perfecting moment by himself on his own strength. And I don't think that Jesus was most upset. I mean, imagine, you know, Peter, you know, if this had been nowadays, it'd been Peter, you know, the first step, take a selfie, you know, walking with Jesus on the water, you know. You've seen all the Calhoun photos of great pictures and portraits that, you know, we've taken as a family. And then if you'd see the off snaps of us yelling at the kids, you know, get that, you know, you better smile. You know, stop crying, now smile. Look at the camera, smile. You see the portrait. We don't take pictures. You know, when Rachel was getting ready to charge me because she was so mad at me, justifiably mad at me, when she's ready to, like, knock my head off, I didn't stop and go, hold on, just playing with babe. You know, that's, we don't show that side of it. But this is the real moment of Peter's exist, like right here. And what does he say? Lord, save me. When all else failed, when he couldn't do it on his own, when they didn't give him a big enough life preserver and the underwater ladder was gone, Lord, save me. And what does Jesus reply? He says, ye of little faith. Yep, verse 31. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, ye of little faith, why did you doubt? Do you think that Jesus' real goal is for Peter to walk on water? I don't think so. Peter's the one who wanted to come to Jesus. It looks like Jesus may have just been fine leaving him. I don't know. Or he knew it was going to happen. His goal is not that Peter would walk on water and learn to walk on water. When he said, ye of little faith, it's because he doubted that he could be saved. It was the fear, it was the worry, it was the exhaustion that he would die before Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. Jesus is not upset, he's not frustrated that you don't have the ability to walk on water. He knows that. He knows that you don't have fins and you can't swim and you can't stay afloat like a dolphin can. He's very much aware, but it's at the thought when you thought you could save it by yourself and you thought you could swim long enough and you thought you were a strong enough swimmer and you knew the ocean well enough that you could take it on all by yourself. That's when he comes in and says, oh, ye of little faith. See, we confuse the three little pigs story with the parable when Jesus said the wise man is the one who builds his house on the rock and the foolish one builds his house on the sand. Sister Sheena talked about this a couple weeks ago on Wednesday. It was the house and she began to talk about the flood. And I realized that in my mind, just the way my mind works, I've always kind of brought the two stories, the two pictures together because I think, okay, yeah, that's right. You got to build the house good because you don't want to build it out of sticks. You don't want to build it out of hay. You know, no, that was the three little pigs. What Jesus' point was, it doesn't focus on what the house was made out of. You can build the house whatever you want, but the house that you're building has to be built on the foundation that when the floods do come, when the rains do come, and I realized my mind and my thought and the way it works in my mind was, oh, if we can keep building a strong house, if we can keep working hard, if we can keep coming to church, if we can keep doing this and keep doing this, and let's put this on the schedule, and let's put that on the schedule, and let's make sure we're doing this, and let's make sure we're doing here, and going here, and taking care of this. And all of a sudden, you're drowning. We got sickness. There are a lot of people here that have things going on, and at some point, when you say, Jesus, I'm drowning, the faith what required was not that you could get through the drowning by yourself, that you could walk on water by yourself, that you could solve all your own problems by yourself. The perfecting part of the faith was being able to reach your hand out and say, Jesus, that's the part. And then Mark goes on, and this is what I find really interesting, because Mark's the one who mentions this, and we see it in verse 52 of Mark chapter 6. He said, they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. And this little story that's a few verses long here is right after one of the biggest miracles in the New Testament, the feeding of the 5,000. It literally, the Lord had just performed the feeding of the 5,000. And here we have this cyclical spiritual amnesia. As soon as our bellies weren't full anymore, and we were tired and exhausted, the cycle came back and we forgot what the Lord was capable of. We forgot that it's not on my strength, it's not on my ability, because I can only swim so long. I can only doggy paddle for so long. I can only be in a boat fighting the winds and the waves for so long before finally the Lord will get you to a place where you can only rely on Him. Lord, get us all into a place where we can only rely on You. Because I will drag this thing out as long as possible on my own strength. I will struggle. I will fight. I will kick. I will do whatever it takes to survive and to keep my head afloat and not let anybody know that I'm drowning because I got a boat full of people watching. And I'm so worried that if I show one sign of weakness, if I make one error, if somebody sees how tired and how exhausted I am in this, how weary I've been from swimming on my own, if somebody can see what I'm holding inside, what I haven't told anybody else, the things that I'm carrying with me on this journey, the clothes that are with me, and we're watered down and we're weighed down, if I could just swim another minute, if I could just swim a little longer. And I think Jesus just stood there and just waited. Get us to that place, Lord. Get us to that place, because Peter's moments became perfecting moments. Because remember, it was Peter that said, "Thou art the Christ." It was Peter who went on, remember? And this was another perfecting moment. Whenever Jesus was telling him everything's going to happen, what did he say? He said, "Not so, Lord, not so." And what did Jesus had to give him another perfecting moment. It was Peter who then tried to take the sword and fight in the garden. It was Peter who said, "I know not the man." 3 times and had to remember that. That was Peter too. Do you see the cycle of spiritual amnesia, of growing and perfecting and learning? And in all of this, I want to also remember that it was Peter when they said, "What must we do to be saved?" It was Peter. And don't you think that when Peter heard that, "What must we do to be saved?" Do you not think that there was something in his heart and in his mind that recalled a time when he needed saved? "I've been through this before. I know how to respond because I've been through this enough times. I've drowned enough. I've messed up enough. I've denied Christ." And then finally, it seems like a huge perfecting moment comes. "What must we do to be saved?" And I think Peter recalled the moments when he was drowning, when he was exhausted, when he couldn't carry on himself, whenever he was just ready to give up, and finally when he cries out to Jesus. And that's basically what he has to tell. "I've been saved. Now let me share it with you." That's the story. But I pray, God, to always take us to that moment when I find myself relying on my own strength, my own ability, when I think I can swim through this far enough, hard enough, when I can just, if I could just get a little bit more done, if I could just not show the weakness that I'm feeling right now, God, get us to that place. And I think that's the place that God wants to get us to, that He takes us through. And Sister Sjostrand just walked in here, and it's super fitting, Sister Sjostrand, because you didn't hear the first part of the story, but on the day me and Rachel had that fight, it was the biggest fight we've ever been in. It was over quickly. We both apologized, and I remember Sister Sjostrand, Tegan, got her tonsils out that day, and we came up to the hospital. I happened to get off work a little bit. I met Rachel there at the hospital, at Children's Hospital, and I said, "Sister Sjostrand," I said, "it just feels like I'm failing every test I'm getting." And I remember she said those comforting words, "Don't worry, baby, you'll get those tests again." And with that, I love you. God bless you.